Welcome to the Undraped Artist Podcast. You should know that this episode was also recorded in video and can be watched on our website at theundrapedartist.com and also on YouTube at the Undraped Artist Podcast. Also, check out our show notes to learn more about today's guest. I hope you enjoy the show.
Gotcha. Okay.
You look great on my end. Yeah. It's all
okay. Good.
Yeah.
So, okay. Sounds great.
Great to have you though. I've been looking forward to meeting you. Sorry we had to cancel a month or so ago, but I'm glad.
Okay. Yeah. No, it was a crazy time around Christmas anyway. So, and that's all good. So, yeah, it's been a busy time actually. I just got back from the US 10 days ago. So,
where were you in the US?
Just in Vermont and Philadelphia, just doing four workshops.
Oh, really?
I went deliberately in March because I wanted to sort of get that snow experience. And thankfully, we got 14 inches of snow on about day five. So
is that my wish came true. Is that your first experience with snow?
No. Okay. I'd been to New Zealand when I was 20. And went skiing there. So we do have some snow in Australia, but it's about 18 hours south. It's the snowy mountains.
18 hours?
Yeah. Australia is about the same size as the US when it comes to area size, just the mainland of the US. So we're a big country, only 25 million people. So
yeah, I've heard that. But you know, when you look at maps because of the curve of the earth, it always looks all small down there.
I think what's the saying? We're the biggest island, smallest continent.
Yeah, man.
So
it only snows down there 18 hours south of you because of the mountains are high there, or
they're higher. Yeah, they're about 7,000 feet, which isn't massive. Australia is one of the, I think, the continent's one of the oldest land masses, so we only have extinct volcanoes. We rarely get earthquakes. We get cyclones or hurricane sort of winds, but it can snow 3 hours south of me, but if it does, it'll last a couple of hours, and that's probably about, what's it, about 2,500-3,000 feet. But yeah, you almost need to live there to see that. But the true snow and the actually, a great movie, if you ever get the chance, is The Man from Snowy River.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a poem from about the 1860s or 1880s. The movie stars Kirk Douglas, and who plays an American. Yeah, it came out in 1980, but I actually just rewatched it about a year ago, and thought, you know what, the movie, the acting, but the scenery is really what takes you away, because it's right in that snowy mountain region where there is snow, and the gum trees, because there's a special type of gum that grows there, the snow gum. They're normally a little shorter and not so sort of big and tall like the ones that you might see in California. I think you might see some in Arizona.
I don't
even
know what a gum tree looks like.
Oh, don't you? Oh,
no,
right.
Maybe I've seen them in California, but I wouldn't be able to point and...
Right. Yeah, they're fairly distinct. They do change through the year. The one thing is, never camp or stay underneath them. They're called widowmakers. They're called widowmakers.
Branches fall off or something?
Yeah. It just happened. Hadn't happened for quite a few years, but it just happened this year or late last year. Unfortunately, some people were camping under one, and it landed straight on there. And they can be...
The whole tree or just a big branch?
Oh, the big branch, yeah. The branch can be as round as your waist, and that's what's coming down from 40, 50 feet. There's not much chance. Yeah.
Dude.
They're beautiful to paint, and they're alluring because you get great shade, great foliage, but, yeah, they can be a little on the dangerous
side. Is it just
because
of the wood? They're just brittle?
Actually, that sort of situation mostly happens, I think, in the south of Australia. And I think they have a big boom and bust with their weather cycles, where Queensland, we're kind of like Florida, 8 months of summer, a little bit of spring, autumn, and about 2 weeks of winter.
Sounds nice.
But Down, oh, if I'm not good in the humidity, but if you look at the southern part of Australia, so we're kind of like you flipped. So the cold comes from the south.
That's what I was thinking when you said further south. It took me a minute. Got, oh yes, further south is closer to the pole. But yeah, everything's flipped.
So it can get up to, actually the record heat that I've been in was 46 degrees Celsius, which is about 118. And I got the cooler day. I flew in before the weather got really hot. So it can go from 120 and it can change overnight
this
as well.
This is where you live.
No, this is down south. Yeah,
oh,
this
down
is
south.
Where the where the gum trees. And because we don't hear of it really happening that much in Queensland, because I think we're a little more stable. But no, so it can go from 120 to 55 in 24 hours because the wind changes direction.
Holy,
their summer is, because it's the southern breeze that brings the cool air, and we have five deserts that brings the hot air from the center of Australia. An artist friend told me about it 20, 25 years ago, and I thought, okay, you know what, we in Queensland we have gum trees, and but I think there's like at least 150 different species.
What is a gum tree?
And he
look
said,
like? Now I'm really curious.
Okay.
I want to look up a gum tree right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, bring up a gum tree. They're that iconic in Australia that over the years there's been artists that they're just gum tree painters. It was probably more of a thing in the sort of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Go
so
to your
is
left.
This, there. This a gum tree?
That's a gum tree. Yeah, yep. And that looks like the bark has peeled off, because it can be a darker, slightly darker brown. Actually, that's more your classic top part of a gum tree.
Oh, yeah.
But that's
that
classic
sculptural
gum tree shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. But normally that looks like a young gum tree. They can be sort of 150 years old and a lot more foliage. That foliage normally really spreads out. And so that's probably more of a younger gum tree. But no. So there's been artists like in the 70s, 80s that they were just gum tree painters. That's how iconic the scene was. And funny thing is, a lot of the artists in California, they'll call it a eucalypt gum tree. And Australians, we just call it a gum tree. So it's just we know they're all
eucalyptus.
Eucalyptus, yeah.
Oh,
but
okay.
The shortening is a eucalypt gum or
okay.
Eucalyptus. Yeah, yeah. Actually, we have koalas just close to us, and they only eat four different species of eucalyptus. So we're lucky that
which is the gum tree, even where you are. So that's what they eat is the gum tree.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the funny thing is, it kind of poisons their body a little. That's why they sleep for 16 or 18 hours a day.
Serious?
But evolution's kind of
screwed up
laid
there,
it that
huh?
way. And but they are down south. They're koalas as well. But gum trees, they could be out in the desert, not right out in the desert, but in the drier regions. We tend to just have our species, and actually my father, he used to paint gum trees quite a bit, and you could almost make, in the 70s, 80s and almost 90s, you could make a full-time living just painting gum trees.
You're kidding me. Was your father a professional artist?
Yep. He's he turned 90 last year.
No kidding.
He's not painting oils as much. He gets a bit of back trouble, which kind of flares up his feet and gets burning in his feet if he's standing too long.
Mm-hmm.
So he's mostly just doing watercolors these days, where he can sort of sit at his watercolor table. And I think I've got one of his gum tree paintings, watercolors, in my collection of paintings that I've got of other artists.
No kidding.
That's
too cool.
Actually, because he painted them so much, I kind of stayed away from them to a degree. I was given the advice as a young painter, because initially I was kind of painting in my father's style and not doing a great job of it either, because he'd been painting 25, 26 years. And a very good artist friend, actually, my father and Terry Gawthorne, Eric Wisson is my father's name, they met in an art class in Brisbane, in my home city, in about 1960, maybe 1959. I don't know the exact date. And I was born in 66. So, and Terry, he became sort of quite a career mentor for me. Terry more went into collecting, not so much painting. But he would loan me $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 paintings to take home and just put on my dressing table to study. And
boy, that's nice.
So now he gave me some, yeah. Oh, yeah, he gave me, and actually I remember you talking to Paul Newton. I had a watch of Paul's episode, and he talked about Graham Minson, who was kind of one of the legendary painters who kind of straddled, because he would have been in his 80s when he passed. He sort of straddled the sort of the 30s, 40s up into sort of almost modern day. And yeah. I think Paul was a student of his.
Are you anywhere near Paul? Friend, or are you?
About 11 hours drive. He's in Sydney.
So you don't know him
and,
then?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. We've chatted online, and maybe next time I get to Sydney, I'll have to give him a yell. And because I think we're the same age, actually. We're all really? Very close to the same age. But no, Terry would loan me his Graham Minson paintings, and we would go to a Graham Minson exhibition because he would have one in Brisbane every year or two. And so it's funny, that crossover in influence. We both identified what we wanted to do, how we wanted to go, even though Paul's gone more into portraiture and figurative work, where I sort of stayed with sort of the landscape, seascape, interiors, and the work that I do. But Graham Minson.
I'm curious, how was your dad an influence on you as a kid?
Well, he was great. Actually, I probably should backpedal and say I'm one of seven children.
Seven kids?
Yeah, no, yeah. And I'm a twin as well. And,
identical or fraternal?
No, fraternal, yeah. He's got blonde hair, fair skin. We apparently look a bit alike in profile, but I more have my mother's rounder face. Actually, it's funny, my twin brother is a spitting image of my father, but he takes after my mother's side, who are all sort of engineers. So he's an electrician.
Hmm.
So he's the black sheep of the family. He's got a real job.
Are you kidding? You mean your other five siblings?
No, I was only joking.
That would have been amazing.
I have two brothers and a sister who sort of paint a little bit, and one was a picture framer who paints probably a little more than the other two. But Dad was quite into sport, and being one of seven kids, we played soccer and cricket and later on golf, and I've been a lifelong fan of playing golf. And actually, I was quite a good sprinter, so I ran at sort of district and state titles as a kid. And when I was, through high school. And so soccer and a lot of sports came fairly easy, and I always thought that might be my future. But then I was doing a bit of work experience as a carpenter, and I was offered an apprenticeship. So instead of finishing grade 11 and 12, as a 15 and a half year old kid, I started carpentry.
When you say carpentry, building houses. Are you referring to like framing houses?
Oh, the whole bit.
Or are you doing cabinets and stuff?
More the house building.
Okay.
We did the drywall. We did the skirting. We even did concreting. We didn't do any plastering.
You're a contractor as much as a carpenter.
Kind of, yeah. See, back in the 80s, you would do like the timber floor. You would do the framework. We even hand chiseled our frames with a chisel and a hammer. I had to use a hand nail and a hammer to make the frame initially, and it was hardwood as well. So
Wait, I'm confused. Then, what do you mean, the framing of the wall?
Yeah.
Use a chisel to frame a wall? How's that?
Yeah. Well, you have a bottom plate and a top plate.
Right.
And to stop the vertical stud from sliding or moving around, you have to do a little checkout. So,
is that code in Australia? We don't do that in the US.
That was the standard way in the 70s and early 80s. It did change when they did just
sense.
Buttered. Yeah. So you would have one person cutting all the top plates and bottom plates and then putting cuts. So you'd have to come and chisel. And it's normally sort of 3 inches by maybe half an inch, but that's where the stud would sit. Then you'd have noggins that would then brace the wall as well, and you'd have a brace going across.
So that resembled more like Asian.
Okay.
Well, I mean, because in the U.S., we don't. They don't, when they frame a wall, it's all just nails. Everything's nails, you know. There's right, no actual right. joinery, but it sounds like you were actually using joinery.
Yeah, well, actually, my early my certificate says that I'm a carpenter and joiner.
Really? So, okay.
Probably the roofs were sort of truss frames which were made in a factory, and you would just come and stand them, and you just had to follow a map. So it eventually did become almost like a jigsaw puzzle where you would have the plan and you just had to stand this there. And so it did become more like a kit frame in the end. Because it was a small gang, I learned how to do a metal roof, stormwater, how to lay bricks as well, because when you got a bit short on work, you'd go and help the bricklayer. So I was even laying bricks as an 18-year-old. So I became a jack of all trades, master of none, I guess, because by about 19, I loved the work, but I didn't really enjoy that my boss. There was a recession in the early 80s. My boss was a bit of an ogre, and I would go off and work with the plumber for a week, and he was such an easygoing guy. I had so much fun. Then Monday next week would come after finishing on Friday and think, oh, no, I've got to go back and work for the ogre. And that started telling
Did you
me.
Did you like plumbing, though? How'd you feel about the actual act of plumbing? I hate plumbing.
I'm terrible at welding. That's what my twin brother got. My twin brother's good at all the metal working. That's why he does welding with the copper wiring every now and then. But I'm terrible at welding. But no, I didn't mind the stormwater and doing the metal roofs. And even though your head's always down and your backside's in the air, so it's hard work on the body. But I learned hard work can be fun.
Yeah.
And I think that was such a great life lesson. I think that I've sort of taken through life, and sometimes some of the previous trips to America, I'd be doing 9 workshops, at most of them 4 days, and over one time I worked 72 days with only the 1 day off. And
oh my gosh, do you have family?
Yeah.
You had to leave for that long?
Yeah. Actually, one of those trips, I think the 2015-17, I would do 9 workshops in the US and then fly to Europe to do a 10-day workshop in Venice. And I've never minded a bit of hard work. And actually, I'm about to fly out to Europe in 6 or 7 days for 6 workshops, 5-day workshops.
5-day workshops.
Yeah, starting in Italy and finishing in Paris.
That would burn me out so bad.
Yeah, actually, you find the first one's probably the hardest one.
Really? Because
even though I did 7 days straight in Philadelphia, because we had to put them back to back because of Easter was right on top of the second workshop, so it was a 4-day and a 3-day. And with the back-to-back workshops in Vermont, I realized, you know what, I did 15 days while I was just recently in the US, and that's half of my European trip. So it's not going to be easy, but the good thing is, how do you have time to paint for
yourself when you're doing that many workshops?
All right. Well, actually, that's a good question, because I'm kind of in the downhill run. This may be sort of my second last workshop in Europe. I've finished ever working in the US as well. My work visa expires this August, and I said to my wife, you know what, after 15 trips and 630 days in the US, I think I've done 85 workshops. I think I'm cooked. I think I've done my bit. And So absolutely, I want to get back to painting more. I normally start when a new year rolls around, I think, okay, time to get busy, time to work hard. And my US trips traditionally are in August, September, October. So I'll do sort of normally one in March, maybe one in April, May, but I'm working flat out for 6-7 months to get a body of work done, new ideas because.
So you compartmentalize your workshop time.
Yeah.
Time. Okay.
Yeah. And actually that's where, so I'll go to Europe, be back in June the 1st. Then I don't have to go away till Tasmania, which is the little island off the bottom of Australia, till November. And Melbourne, till November. So, but it is a slow wind down. I'll do less next year, and then I'll sort of think, you know what, maybe that's it for me, and then I'll be able to just paint full time again, and maybe take on another gallery or two. And because at the moment we only have the one gallery, and that's here in Australia. And because I used to have work in Salt Lake City, and I did a few workshops in. I did I think it's two workshops in Salt Lake City, and at least two in St. George as well.
When were you here?
Let's think. It was 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, and I think 21. So it must be a few more than the.
Two or three.
Yeah, well.
I was here all that time. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no. It was super hot in Salt Lake. So,
but, you came in the summer?
St. George wasn't so bad, even though it was still hot. But we went up to Pine Valley. Have you ever been up to Pine Valley? I think it's almost directly north. Okay, Pine Valley, yeah.
Where is Pine Valley?
Because, I'm pretty sure it's about 45 minutes fairly north of, just north of St. George.
Okay.
But it's up another 2,000 or 3,000 feet.
Is it up near Cedar City area? Is that right, Bell?
No, I think Cedar City is a little towards the east.
Okay.
And it's not well known, I don't think. It's got just a handful of houses up there, and but it's just a charming little place. And instead of being 98 degrees, it was 78 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
So we were able to have a marvelous plein air painting day there. And now I do love Utah. I think St. George is not far from, or it's on the direction of Zion.
Yeah.
Yep. I didn't get right into there, but
Zion's gorgeous.
Time was. We sort of went the direction. Oh, there's a little town, and I just can't remember it. Not Jamaica.
Springdale.
It's a town or area that you don't sort of expect. But not to worry.
I can't believe you've been in Utah many times. Man, you've been everywhere. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I've been to 24 states. Been to 24 states.
I haven't been to 24 states, and I'm American. Holy crap.
Right. I think I've taught in 16 or 17 of them now. So.
Wow. That's unbelievable. I don't think I could. I think that just the plane ride alone. Well, I don't think. I know. I've been invited to do international workshops, and I hate flying a long way.
Right.
So I just always say no.
Yeah.
I'm just like, nah.
All right.
I mean, I'm going to eventually, I'm going to do one with Rosemary Brushes at some point, but like, that's not that far. But I've been invited to Africa, and I'm like, 24 hours? No, I'll pass.
Yeah. Right. The trip to Vermont this year, it was about 34 hours.
Oh, my God. That's awful.
Yeah. No, no.
You
actually,
don't mind
see,
it?
I've flown across the Pacific sort of 28 times now, sort of going there and coming back.
God. Yeah, you have to be built for it. If you don't mind it.
I think I've got a little hack. First, it doesn't hurt if you, say, can fly from, say, Brisbane to LA. So if you're going to Africa, you would probably go sort of from say Salt Lake City to New York, stay there 2 or 3 days. So you kind of acclimatize yourself a little. And then I think you would probably fly from New York down south. I'm not sure of the route, but so for me, from Philadelphia, it was 6 hours just to LA. This time I didn't get the chance. I had to get home sooner than later. My wife had actually had a small operation. Thankfully it all went well and
good.
She had a cyst. So I was keen to, I was home when the operation was, so it was 30 days before I left, 30 something days. But when I hopped on the plane, I think to myself, you know what, I've got 14 hours to myself. I can watch this, I can listen to that. I hope I've got enough time.
Are you kidding?
To listen to all the things.
I would die.
Yeah, yeah.
Difference in personality is amazing.
You know, when you're, evening now, but say if it's 8 in the morning, you think, you know what, I've got to water this, do that, do this with the kids or and think, geez, how am I going to get all this done in the day? You want to paint, you want to do this. And you know how fast the day goes?
Yeah.
Well, when you're on the plane, like I only watched one movie this time on the flight home. I listened to a lot of music. Because I do an online course, I'll save a little bit of work, 2 hours gone there. I'm thinking, geez, I'm going to run out of time. I'm not going to get time for every. So that's my little hack. Yeah, yeah.
Do you fly first class at least so you have a little room?
Oh, wishful thinking.
Oh,
wishful
man,
thinking.
Dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a beast. I couldn't do it.
Yeah. No, no. Actually, this last trip over and back, actually, I had no one sitting beside me, so I just had the window and a spare seat, so that wasn't too bad. So
yeah, that's
nice. Sort of lay down a little. Actually, my oldest son is coming with me because my wife was meant to come with me to the US this year, but with the operation, no doctor would allow her to fly, and because this was kind of my encore trip, this was just to finish up. Quite a few students missed the last September, October's workshops, so we scheduled these four. But my oldest son's coming, and he's 6'8".
Holy crap! How tall are you?
Yeah. Well, I always joke I was 6'2" before I joined the parachute corps, and it's all those jumps, and I'm only 5'10" now.
So, you had a kid, you're 5'10" and you got a 6'8" son. Yeah, is your wife tall?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, she's only 5'6", 5'7". I come up to just above his shoulder. But my
Are
grandfather
you sure he's
was
your kid?
6'5".
Have you checked his DNA?
Well, yeah, actually, when you see him, unfortunately we're the spitting image. So
he's just a big
my youngest son.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My grandfather was might have been my great grandfather. He was 6'5". My twin brother's nearly 6 foot. Another brother's nearly 6. My wife's got 6'2", 6'4" brothers and 6'5" cousins. And but yeah, wow. We didn't expect him to grow. They were worried he had gigantism when he was 15 or 16. Thought
yeah,
maybe this
really tall.
Yeah, yeah. So he's got premium economy, and unfortunately, instead of flying with the A380, we've got to go on the smaller plane, which sometimes they can get a little squishy. Because I flew to England and Ireland June last year, and that had been the first time I'd flown to Europe since 2019, and that was a bit of a physical test because it's 14 hours to Dubai, then another 7 hours, 8 hours-ish onto
you're
London.
Stressing me out.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to get off this whole flying thing. I hate it so bad.
Yeah.
All right, we got to back up though, because I'm curious about this whole construction thing. How did you How did you get from construction to painting? When did you make that switch?
So turned sort of 19, and actually my twin brother and I, because he's quite brilliant at the mathematical side, where I've got more the visual, the creative side. And so we were planning a little construction company together, and we even picked out a name. His name's Barry, and being Collie, it was going to be Colbar Construction or Bar Coal Construction. And playing sport, I just strained some ligaments in my right knee, and this was a bit of an impending, you know what, I'm starting to get some back trouble and a little bit of sciatic sort of trouble and bulging discs. And
as a teenager?
So I, we were sort of working on a shovel when I was 8 or 9 and doing fairly, and I didn't mind doing it. It makes you strong, makes you fit, makes you healthy. And my father had a small picture framing business that an older brother was running, and he was going to Europe to train with a German soccer club and needed someone to keep the business going. So with my woodworking at high school and carpentry, I seemed to be the perfect fit. So I got a two-three-week crash course how to be a picture framer and how to picture frame. So I did that for about 10 months. And then when he came back, it was his business. So he took it over for the next 20, 25 years.
Hmm.
My twin brother and I, we weren't doing much. And my father actually had a young student, Giles Lane, who we painted together for about 10 or 15 years or 12 or 15 years. But Giles, I think he sort of didn't quite make it. He didn't quite have that thick skin. He would put paintings in exhibitions and galleries and, oh, that's not good enough, and take it back. Instead of trying to learn from the experience, and then adapt. See, I'm not sure if Giles is painting anymore, but Dad thought, oh, you know what? Giles is about the twins' age. So it was the first Tuesday night in June 1986. My father got us down to paint. My twin brother lasted about two lessons and has never painted since, probably never even looked at a brush unless he's painting the wall. Mm-hmm. So I found after a couple of months, I said to my father, you know what, I think I'm keen to give this a go. Actually, in between, my twin brother and I went for that New Zealand trip, which is only about 3 hours flight away from Brisbane to Auckland, 2.5 hours. And it was actually a great eye-opener to sort of see a different landscape as well. And I thought, you know what, I think there's no pressure for me to be good at it. There was no pressure for me to even do it. But I quickly found I was learning fast. And with the pivot to a different style, which was more the Australian School of Painting, which is out of Melbourne. It's named after a suburb called the Heidelberg School. I could highly recommend. You may have heard of Arthur Streeton. He's probably one of the better known artists. Frederick McCubbin, Charles Conder, Tom Roberts, David Davies, Walter Withers. So I more migrated, and I think my eye really was taken by their work. Terry, after saying
you sent me a bunch of images. Are some of those artists on those images?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah,
let's,
yeah.
Let's
that's
pull
kind
some
of
those up real quick here.
Yeah, yeah. Give me that's one kind second. Of that. Yeah, we're sort of there's the French Impressionists. The Scottish have their Glasgow School. Not sure if England they have a few smaller schools. Yeah, that top left one. I think where the big building, that's a Streeton, and the one beside it, the landscape. Yeah, that's a Streeton there. That's from Vancouver. His wife was Canadian born. They met in England in the late 1890s or early 1900s. Yeah, so that's from, I think it's the Grand Empress or the Empress Hotel in on Victoria Island. Just to the right of that is, I think, the Parliament House. And the one, the landscape with the blue hills going back, that's
this
another street.
And this one here?
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's more probably classic what Streeton painted. And he just had an innate sense to paint distance and depth. And I think that imprinted, because I said to Terry Gawthorne when he said, oh, whatever you do, don't paint like your dad or your, like, if it was your grandfather, uncle, I would say you've got to find a different way, a way that suits you or anything but the way your father paints.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, how do I find that? And actually, if you go down the three down below, there's a, looks like a cave, but it's a vertical one. There's three down below. If you go up, that was a Trevor Chamberlain. You go up the blue water one with the white. Yeah.
That looks like a cave.
That one's a Streeton.
Okay.
And there's two to the left, I think.
Oh, right
yeah,
here.
Actually,
right
there, here. Yeah, that's a Streeton. He painted that one when he was 26. It's 4 foot by 2 foot.
God, that one's gorgeous.
Actually, for years I would go to, that's in the Sydney, the Art Gallery in New South Wales in Sydney. Paul would have seen this dozens of times because it's normally always on display.
Okay, you're a landscape painter. What is it about this that makes it so successful?
I think he had such a great ability with light. His contrast from light to dark, he would be able, and a lot of people always sort of think, oh, you shouldn't put nearly a black next to a nearly a white. But Streeton did that and got away with it scot-free. He was like a bank robber robbing a bank, I always felt. Composition-wise, Streeton was a little on the awkward side. Sometimes he would have, like, his figures are a little stiff, and there are some stiff, not sort of where an artist that he was about the same age, Charles Conder, taught him a lot and influenced him quite a bit. But it's that blue sky, that row of trees right up on the hill, that's kind of a big bunch of gum trees there, eucalyptus gum trees there. That's how they sort of, when you get a whole row of them, they get that lovely warm colour, that warm sort of reddy green. But no, Terry, he took me into our gallery in Brisbane. Yeah, if you drag him down, yeah. So And I used to marvel, and it took me 20 years to work out how did he paint this? Because normally I can see a oil painting and work out, oh, okay, yeah, this is how he's done it. That's how he's done it. And
well, it looks simple Terry when showed you look me, at it, but I know I couldn't paint anything like this.
Yeah. But if you have a look at that rock to the, not sure if it's your left away right from a little, because that big rock there. And then he's also got a little carriage where they're, and people, because the story of this painting is that they were blowing up the tunnel to build a train line through, and the word would go out, fire, fire's on. So that meant the dynamite had been lit. And so, sadly, a poor guy got trapped, and I'm not sure if he made it out alive. But, so Terry Gawthorne, he said, pick me up. And we'll go into, because we used to do sort of a thing that was like a pub crawl, but a gallery crawl. So he took me to the Queensland Art Gallery. We call them more art galleries, not museums. A museum in Australia is where you'll have dinosaurs and planes and all biplanes. So we call it more of a regional gallery, state gallery, or a national gallery. And he took me to the realists and then the abstract painters, and then to the Impressionists. And when I saw one of Streeton's, actually, Jeff, if you can go to that other one where there's a yacht, blue water, and there's a yacht bottom left.
Okay.
It's just two.
Right here?
Oh, no, if you go up, no. If you go up, you were quite close to it. Yeah, right there, yeah. That's actually, I saw the study of this painting. It was only about 18 by about 8 inches. But this is 3 foot by 2 foot, I think, or 4 foot by 2 foot. So I saw the study of this painting, and I can still remember the day I got goosebumps on the back of my neck, and I thought, you know, I don't want to, even though I've done, this is a Sydney Harbour painting. Once again, like the Gumtree, a lot of artists have become Sydney Harbour painters because it's such a paintable subject.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 20 years, I don't paint coastal scenes or beach scenes or the Sydney Harbour as much. I've tried to expand my repertoire as well with, and that's why I've loved coming to the US. But so after seeing this one of Streeton's, I then went to some Melbourne painters, Dale Marsh, Maxwell Wilkes, then to a couple of Sydney painters because they were more highly influenced by the Heidelberg School, Streeton. Streeton did live in Sydney for a while he was painting these scenes, and they had a strong influence of plein air painting as well. That was brought to Australia by Tom Roberts in about 1882. He was English born, but Australian raised and educated. And I think he was about 8 years old when he first came, but he'd make trips back to England to study and study in Paris. He was he had his portrait painted by, not Calas, the great Spanish painter, not Sorolla, Ramon Casas. And another painter painted Van Gogh's portrait. So there was a bit of a cross-pollination. What's his name? Emmanuel Phillips Fox painted Van Gogh's portrait. And it's one of my favourite portraits, and I think it's one of the best portraits that anyone sort of painted of Vincent Van Gogh. So there was that 1880s cross-pollination, probably just after Jules Bastien Lepage and when Monet was coming through. And so, yeah, so that was brought directly to Australia. We've got to get out of the studio, stop painting from sketches and paint from life. We still have quite a powerful school of painters. Oops, yep, sorry.
You've definitely picked out more, some inspiring works here. I mean, that's what you call this folder, your inspiration.
Actually, they're kind of the five artists, so that's a Streeton up there.
I like this
the one beside it. See that light, you can almost feel like you could walk into that and walk up the dirt road. He just painted the light so so powerfully. And that's why a good artist friend said to me, you know, with the Heidelberg School, with the painters that came after them, There's one of the watercolorists that is in that list. They set the bar so high that, yeah, so if you pick up to the left, there's a little poplar tree one. If you just go up there, yeah, those two up.
Right here. Yep,
This is watercolor? Yeah, that's a Harold. Yeah, that's a Harold Herbert. He was really the first Australian painter to really paint the Australian light and colour in watercolour and do it so fluently. And so these guys, just to see how easy they made it look and how spectacular they made it look. And Harold Herbert's not really that well known, even in Australia, sadly. He was a star in his day in the 20s and more the 30s. But his longevity hasn't lived on, unfortunately. But to artists, most of the artists in Australia know of his work. And say if you look at Joseph Zabukvich, Alvaro Castanet, Herman Peckel, David Taylor, Ross Patterson, there's a whole. Oh, right. I could always send you a list of.
Yeah, these are great.
But yeah, but there was that 1880s. And kind of Impressionism kind of finished, I guess, worldwide in the 20s. And then it was kind of the post-Impressionism and Picasso was sort of everything. And actually my father's cousin, that's a David Curtis.
I hope you don't mind. I'm pulling up some of my favorites.
No. Yeah, that's David Curtis. Actually, I got the great opportunity, wonderful opportunity to paint with David up in Stades, where this painting, actually where that little figure is on the beach, if you zoomed in, that's about where I was standing, and David was just to my left with a few of the northern boys. So that was about where I was painting. Unfortunately, it wasn't a sunny day as this, but...
Do you have the painting you did from that location?
I do. I think it's just down in my little plein air little folder there.
No kidding.
So actually David and I swapped a painting as well, and... So he's good friends with Trevor Chamberlain. I'm not sure if you know of Trevor's work.
No, but, these are all, you're really educating me here.
Yeah. So that's another Streeton. Actually, I introduced Richard Schmid to Streeton. I was fortunate to get to meet Richard in 2019, and that one was actually one of his favorites.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
And that was, I think, in Streeton's backyard. So. Probably from about the late 1920s, but I'll just get back to Picasso then starting to kind of rule the art world. And so my father's cousin Ken Wisson, he was a young painter. He was born, he just passed away at 94, but he was born in 1927. So when he was 17, 18, he was told, if you paint like Streeton, you're going to be nothing. You're going to be nobody. You'll be forgotten to the art world. So,
because Picasso is a big deal, you need to do something modern.
Yeah. So, and that's why I always wonder if Ken was born 10 or 15 years earlier or later, what style? If you Google Ken Wisson, and one of his paintings sold for, I meant to put a painting of his on the list, but.
Wait, Ken, I'm sorry. I must have missed something. Your dad's name's Eric.
Yep, Ken is dad's cousin.
My
father's cousin, yeah. So Ken and Eric Wisson.
Good bloodline.
Their grandfathers were brothers, Charles
and Herbert
Wisson.
This is your dad's cousin? So he was totally riding the Picasso wave.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was trained by a Russian painter. Yeah, that's probably not a... Yeah, if you... There's Ken, actually, he's in the blue shirt. Actually, looks a lot like my twin brother. He's got more the angular face.
Yeah.
So I got to meet and spend a bit of time.
Your second cousin.
Third cousin. Yeah, dad's second cousin, yeah. Because it was their grandfather. So he went the very modern way.
Yes, he did.
But the one family thing is colour. My father was known as a great colourist, and I think that was passed on to myself. And I rode that way for probably 12, 15 years. And then I realized I hit a brick wall in about 1993, 94, 95, that period. It was around the same time that I met my wife and we got married and moved in together. And I think not having my father's guidance there, but my wife's a great judge of art as well. And
I'm pulling up your dad's work here.
Okay, that's a really old one. Oh yeah, that's a really early 70s one. If you go to the one that's about one more in that, that's one of his street scenes, but and they were very that's a very early one as well. Unfortunately, dad's of that era where you see that's about 1972 74 75. That's a little later. That's when he probably if you can go back to that one, Jeff. The one before. No, another three or four on. Go further the other way, sorry.
Oh, the other way.
Yeah. Keep going. Yeah, that one there. That was probably late 70s, more early 80s. That's when he started to refine his approach.
What do you mean by refine his approach? He's just sort of finally zeroing in on who he is as an artist?
Yeah. Actually, the early work was mostly palette knife, so they were quite... broad and I think he then later used more brush and a little bit of palette knife. So he was then able to combine the both. And I think he got a more mature looking look to his work than the ones that you showed were really when he was kind of just starting out professionally in about 1970. And even I can even see the lyrical quality of it where and figures weren't his great big thing, but how he's sculpted that tree in the sort of just to the right of the center, and he's sort of got that shadow. I can see where he's placing the limbs, and but having seven kids and having to provide for them, he wasn't able to really put in as much time that I was, because I painted 6 days a week for 12 years from 20 until 12 or 13 years when my Alex was born, and then Travis was born 2 years after that.
So what was your dad's day job then?
In his 20s, he was a ticket writer, which is a bit like a sign writer, but he did it which was actually using paint. He would work in a studio near the city, just out of the city, called Fortitude Valley. And in those days, they would probably phone the order through, we need a sign. 20% off summer coats. So he would write up. So it was like sign writing, but it was called ticket writing. So it was like a ticket that would go in the department store window where they do it with probably computers now and all that. Then he sort of drifted into a little bit of farming. We had radish farm, and he had a fruit shop. And but then by his late 20s, sort of about 30, that's when I think a few of the mothers and fathers where we used to play soccer wanted to learn to paint, and they said to my father, can you teach us to paint? And he said, well, I've only really been studying a little bit. But they said, you know what, you know more than us. So that's sort of, I think it was about 1970, I think I was turning 3 and a half, 4, but that were kind of a golden era. We had 3 acres, and in that backyard we grew the radishes. We had a tractor and chickens, a cow, even a goat for a little while. And and with 5 brothers and 2 sisters, you could play soccer in the front yard, play a little bit of cricket. And so no, it was really quite ideal.
But then he also sheds. He taught. So he did farming and he taught art at the same time.
Yeah. Even though once the teaching started to take off, and he taught about 1,000 different students, and he would he'd have 100 students a week. So he would teach Monday morning and afternoon.
Wait a minute, you lived Tuesday, on 3 acres, Thursday. And there was even 100 people to teach?
Through the week. I only live about a mile away from where I grew up. And actually, my block of land was an old pineapple farm. There was a dairy across the road and farms beside us, or farmland beside us. We would walk up the street to go to school, and there was acres of pineapple farms.
So where'd all these people come from?
Oh, from the city, mostly sort of, because we were only 30 minutes away from the city, and this was before the big highway came as well. So,
wow.
I know, we had such a big, Yeah. Actually, a lot of people wonder where I got my approach or style or ideas for teaching, but it was really from my father. I would go with him. He would go and do workshops in the country, sort of 3, 4, 5, 6 hours drive away. And as a teenager, my twin brother and I, we would take turns in driving an hour and he would drive an hour. Dad would go and teach. But when I got to 20, I would start, if there was room, I would sit right at the back of the room and paint away, sort of looking what everyone was doing. And so I sort of thought, you know what, he would teach in a step-by-step process. He would do the blocking, then everyone would go and do that. Then he'd do the mid section and then the final section, normally about 2 o'clock, and you'd finish about 4, 4:30. And I thought, geez, if I remember as a 22, 23-year-old, I thought, you know what, if I ever get asked to teach, I'm going to teach exactly that same way, because it's breaking it down to really bite-sized pieces. People who are just learning, everything is difficult, as you would remember when you start painting. I always equate it to, like, when you start painting, it's like you're trying to juggle one ball at a time. But then when it gets a little harder, it's 2 balls, 3 balls. Ah, yes, that's my father. Him and I are about the same age. Yeah. Actually, that's a little painting in behind his right shoulder of mine. And you can see it's kind of like a gum tree shape, yeah. But that's one of my dad's paintings. That's more sort of, say, 88, 89. Yeah, so Dad and I are about the same age there, sort of 57, 56-ish. That's gotta be kind of a trip, huh? Oh, absolutely. I used to paint when we do studio painting, 2 yards or meters, about the same distance, to his right. So where he's facing, I would have his old easel, and that was his newer easel, even though it was probably 10 years old.
Can I just take a minute to recognize the people and companies that make this podcast possible? First, I want to thank you, my patrons. You are absolutely the most important and necessary sponsors of this podcast. Without you, we couldn't keep this thing going. If you love the show and are not yet a patron, please consider helping out. Go to theundrapedartist.com and click on the link Be My Patron on Podbean. And then just pick a monthly amount that fits your budget. What are 4 great podcasts a month worth to you? In my opinion, my sponsor Rosemary Brushes makes the best artist brushes available today. They have a huge inventory and are constantly innovating and adding new and interesting brushes to their line. They ship all over the world, and due to their exceptional customer service, you won't wait long to receive your order. To order some brushes for yourself, go to rosemaryandco.com. The Hein Atelier began over 20 years ago in 2002. Due to limited space and high demand, in 2022, I adapted the entire curriculum to an online platform. While on our website and mobile app, students will find hundreds of hours of valuable recorded content, this online atelier is not just a website full of lessons, tutorials, and other resources. In this program, I personally mentor each student toward their artistic goals through weekly Zoom critiques, instruction, and regular in-app communications. To learn more or to sign up, go to heinatelier.com. Lastly, whether you're watching or listening on Apple Podcasts or just listening on another station like Spotify, please consider leaving me a 5-star review. If you watch on YouTube, consider giving me a follow and a thumbs up. These things really help the channel.
And I had his sort of 15, 20-year-old easel.
So what took so long for you to start taking lessons? If you're living with an artist who teaches 1,000 people, and it sounds like you didn't even start till after you did the contracting thing or the carpentry
thing.
Yeah,
My younger sister, she did art through all of school. Mm-hmm. Apparently the story is when we were in grade 8, it was kind of compulsory. Everyone did art. I think everyone also almost had to do the woodworking, metalworking, technical drawing, which is like a drafting course. And I always loved the drafting and always thought,
when you say they had to do, do you mean in public school or at your home?
No, public schooling. Okay. Yeah. It was as far as I can, and it was more grade 10, 11 and 12. That's when, okay, if you wanted to be a doctor or something, you'd do biology and science and all that. But I always thought, you know, I would love to do, I love the drawing. I love perspective. So I always thought I would have loved to have been an architect. So I loved the drafting course, which was called technical drawing. Mm-hmm. And in the art class, we were doing paper mache and leather carving, and we weren't doing any painting at all. And apparently my mum said, oh, what do you want to do for next year? Do you want to continue with art? And apparently my twin brother and I said, well, it's not what Dad's doing. It's not real art. It's not painting. So I continued with the technical drawing sort of, and I did do science as well. I was very good at science for some reason. I don't know how or why, but not good at mathematics, except for trigonometry, which is all about triangles.
Shape, and yeah.
You'll know how important triangles are. So mm-hmm. I had an innate sense with trigonometry and I guess for triangles, and a love affair, I guess, with triangles. So my younger sister did the art, and I said to her about 10 years ago, I said, I thought you were every person who said when we were kids, teenagers, but I would say, I thought you were going to be the artist, because she said, no, I only did it to get out of home economics, which was like cooking and cooking and doing all that stuff. She wanted to be a modern girl. And I always loved going to art shows though. And even from a 3, 4, 5-year-old kid, we would kind of sometimes go to an exhibition where my father would demonstrate. And and I always found it an enjoyable thing. It's not like, imagine when you're 12 or 13 and your parents said, why don't you come and say if your dad's a mechanic or anything, sort of a sales rep, how about you come selling sort of stuff? How about you come with me to work? And you think, oh, no, thanks. Where I would go to exhibitions and art galleries, and it was a fun space. It was always a bit of a wonderland where I became quite a harsh critic. I would stand in front of a painting, that's not very good. Go to the next one, oh, that's very good. So apparently as a 8, 10, 12-year-old, I became quite a, whether I knew what I was looking at or knowing was good or bad, but I became quite critical and or discerning, I guess. I would sort of have that, you know what, there's good painters, there's not every painting there is a great painting. So I started learning. So that's why I kind of had like an apprenticeship as a kid. Then I did the picture framing, which was almost like an apprenticeship as an adult, framing other people's work, because then I went on to frame my own work for I'm still kind of doing a little bit of picture framing of my own work. Actually, you can see probably the frame, oops, wrong side.
Yeah,
the frame up
is
here,
that one
which
of yours?
Yep, it's cool. Without a painting at the moment. I took the painting out and I've probably got it, oops, wrong way. So I probably can't see, but no, so.
Is that white? Is that white wood or canvas wrapped wood?
It is, it's a off-white or white painted timber. Mm. So they have it go through a conveyor belt with airless spray guns. So you get a beautiful smooth finish on a timber. You guys more have the linen finish, where for us that was kind of old fashioned 30.
Oh, we don't do that anymore. Maybe. That's pretty old school here too.
Yeah. I've seen a few people do it, but yeah, it's considered really old school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where it's a 3-inch off-white. It's looking a little yellow on my monitor.
Yeah, you can tell it's white. It's a pretty frame.
Oh, good, yeah. Yeah. And then I used to put a gold frame around them, but I found that was kind of competing with the use of color that I was trying to get. So actually, I've probably got a little guy here because I used to do, sorry about this, I used to do a lot of finches, and a zebra finch. I'll just see if I can bring it in. I'm not sure. Yeah, but that's one that I've framed up, and so you can sort of see it a little better.
Yeah, that's pretty.
So actually, a lot of times these little 10x8s are my warm-up painting for when I do sort of my 2x3s or 3x4s. I'll get into, this is my studio, so I'll get in about 8 in the morning. And I always find I'm a slow starter, so that's why sometimes when I'm out painting in the morning, my first little plein air painting might be a 6x8, 10x8, and I think of it as a little throwaway painting. I try not to put too much pressure on myself. I've tried for, it's going on 38 years, I've tried to be able to just go and snap out a great painting. Even if I've painted 15 days plein air every day before, the next day I'm still a little cold, but I get stronger and stronger through that painting day. So that's why in that second hour, third, fourth, fifth hour, and it just seems to be how I'm made. My twin brother, he probably burns out a little quicker, where he nicknamed me the Ever Ready Battery when we were, because I helped him build his house. And one time I worked 24 and a half hours straight. And So he nicknamed me the Ever Ready Battery. I was doing all the internal moldings and all that. So, and I thought, you know what, don't fight it. Just try and stick to the principles of what you did the day before. Just because there's always that tendency, you come in front of a good subject and think, oh, that's so good. How am I going to do it justice? And it does psych you out a little bit. For many years, I actually drew on the spot for 3 years before I ever painted, or after my first failure with Giles. We went out painting and I made a complete mess of it, driving home thinking, here I am wanting to be the next, or not the next Streeton, but the next great plein air painter to keep that tradition going. And I made a mess of it. And I thought, driving home, what can I do? That was hopeless. That was terrible. So I then thought, well, you know what, drawing, I'll do it for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. It took me 3 years. But in hindsight, I think that's what's taught me how to not only draw and compose, but and to have that hand-to-eye coordination, but it's also taught me to see. And I think that's the greatest lesson. I can now sort of almost, you can blindfold me, and I've almost done a painting from every state except for maybe New Hampshire, which is probably one of the newest states that I've been to. I've done a painting from every state. That's so it's amazing. Taught me how to just to walk in. And I've been to South Africa, New Zealand, Greece, Italy, France, England, Ireland. I think I've been to about 15 different countries. But it's taught me how to see light as well, how to get that contrast to work initially. So I see a subject just as a black and white image first. I did about 12 years of serious drawing. And I probably did actually the big turning
point. When you say drawing, what were you drawing?
It was, I can probably, if you don't mind, if you don't mind me backing back, I've got my old drawings here. Oops, just see if I can get these guys out. Sorry about this. I've just got some of my paintings caught there. You might just have to edit this that bit out. But no, actually, that's a drawing that my son did as a 12-year-old.
Oh, he's good.
He's now 23. Yeah, yeah, he does. He's doing digital art and he's working on that. But actually, this is fun because it's like this is a little watercolor that I did on my first trip to Europe.
That's pretty.
My father gave me a go at watercolor. And so I have done a lot of sort of still life over the years as well. I've used that as a training technique. That's just a little one on canvas. But let's get to the main game, and where see, so this would be sort of something that I would draw. I would just draw sort of anything and everything.
Drawing, just your environment.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, my wife and I were staying right near this fountain, and it kept me up all night with the water trickling. So I thought I'm going to get revenge on that fountain. See, these are from the tree on the on this side is probably a little. Oops, other side is a little stiff, but yeah, that's
is that
kind
graphite?
Of wrong way. Yes, yeah, yeah. I'd normally use a 2B, 4B, 6B pencil.
Looks like you draw with the side of the pencil a lot.
A lot, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not, I may put in some little accents with the sharpest edge. I'll just see if I can find. Actually, this is from my old studio. So I did a big 2x3 on this
way,
one.
Yeah.
It's always hard to, my other
backwards.
Right.
So those are nice.
So, and I did a big, so I would draw ahead of time. I would be doing drawings that became my paintings.
So you really
sometimes
think
it would take a while.
When you draw.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And see, this one became a painting eventually. This is St. Remy in France. I did do quite a bit of drawing on the spot on that trip, and I was mostly a plein air, it sounds wrong, but draftsman. I used to draw, and then they, and that's that same little
that
shed.
That was great.
So these were sort of, actually these are from sort of the late 90s.
Those are great.
Because I was fortunate. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be asked to write a book. So those little yellow dots, they came or eventually went into my first book, which was published by International Artists. A lot of times.
That's inspiring. I like those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember seeing a Van Gogh. Actually, this was one in 95. My wife was matron of honor, and she said, you may as well go out and entertain yourself. Oops, wrong way again. So I did
this
little one on the spot.
That's complex right there. Nice perspective.
Yeah. It's a beautiful building. I painted that one and painted that building from, let's say, this side and around the corner. It's in Melbourne. But I would just be there.
Do you use a sketch like that? Do you transfer sketches like that?
Absolutely. That really was, if I had a secret to my success, it was really the time I spent drawing, because it taught me, okay, where to place those big shapes, where to sort of put the major elements, the darks, the lights. I was then being able to micromanage and understand what was sort of coming up next. And I mentioned Giles, my artist friend. We would go into the, he would catch the train into the city. I would catch the train in. We'd meet in Central Station or Roma Station, and we'd go and draw the building. Actually, this was, we found out that Roma Street Station was going to be torn down. And actually, this scene was just a quick little sort of half-hour sketch, but it's got sort of the
really
town hall
beautiful.
In the background. Yeah, very simple, but that became my engine room to what led me to the success early on. So by the time I was 35, the first book came out, and then I did another book at 41, 42 for International Artists. And because International Artists started in Sydney in Australia, there was an Australian artist magazine and then became the International Artists.
When you say that led to your success, do you mean the practice drawing led to your success, or the literally the process of doing a drawing before you do a painting was what led to your success?
Absolutely, yeah. I think so, yeah.
Which one, the latter or the former, or both?
I think probably both.
Okay.
Because I think I then migrated more to doing just like tonal plans, really quick tonal plans or line drawings. But I think actually, Jeff, the best thing that I think it taught me was how little do I need to say so much, to say heaps, to say a great deal. I think it was that ability, because I would draw sort of fountains and quite intricate scenes, but I thought, you know what? You don't need all of that. That's why this little guy, I did do a little oil from that one. That's in St. Remy. That's where Van Gogh spent some of his time convalescing. And I did a little lovely little oil from that. And it was simplifying, or not really simplifying, it was more educating me to know what was required to construct a scene. Because my father and I, we nicknamed it the Grand Canyon effect. You know how often when you go out to paint, you want that, oh, look how magnificent, even though I've never seen the Grand Canyon, but I've got close. But
you've been to all these different places and you haven't been to the Grand Canyon
yeah.
yet.
Yeah,
holy
yeah.
cow, man.
And, yeah. Actually, my good friend Gabor, who I should give a little plug, who runs Tucson Art Academy. I'm not sure if you know of Gabor Zwarik. I always butcher his surname. But, you know, Matt Smith and Skip Whitcomb and Mitch Baird and... Yeah, we all teach for Gabor, and he lives just a couple of hours south. But actually, I more want to go to Canyon de Chelly and some of the more lesser painted areas of that. It's not probably part of the Grand Canyon, I don't think. But we sort of thought, you know what, so many people go out and think, oh, you've got to be that awe-inspired by the scene. It's almost like a take-your-breath-away moment where here's another little guy just in Siena. This was
just a
on the walk.
Place. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was on the walk from my hotel into downtown Siena. And it's a light effect. It's a statement of line. And but then after about 20 years or 18 years, I realized, you know what, I'm plateauing again. That's when I started doing the the little still life exercises, and I'll see if I can find those guys. But I would sort of grab and could even take a photo of my mother-in-law's little puppy dog as he was sitting on the tiles. And but no, I'd grab anything around the house. So that's just a little one of Sonic. So these are actually, that was for my older son. But yeah, these are all fun things. This was a little, we had a rained out day in Italy. So we went in and did a master copy. We were allowed in to do a master copy of the of one of the masters. But no, so I would do, and this is what really powered the second half of my career, was doing hundreds of these. I would set a timer for about 35 to 45 minutes, not to see how good I could paint. And when I got better at them, I would escalate the degree of difficulty. But it was more about trying to teach me to see light, dark, warm, cold, shape, edge, and then am I retreating back to get that global view. So they really did.
So you're restricting your time to force yourself to think about the most important elements of painting.
Absolutely, yeah. So it was teaching me to edit.
Yeah.
What to see, what was visually the most important. And I think with the drawing, which set me up, that's why it breaks your heart when students will come and say, oh, I was told by my university professor drawing was old-fashioned. I don't need to do that anymore. And yet it kind of think, oh my God, it truly is the thing that's got me half the way to what I'm doing today. But then I realized I'd plateaued, and then the still life, but also actually painting in a new area. I think that's why going to Ireland, I'd never painted castles. We were at in the Galway area. There was abbeys and castles, a completely different color sense and temperature approach was required, where Australia is like California, a little bit like the light in Utah. It's warm. It's Queensland's called the Sunshine State. Now, if I look out the window, there's not a cloud in the sky, perfect blue sky. So it's good to go to those areas that, you know what, it's much greener. So the base light to dark isn't as contrasty. So that was a fantastic experience. Actually, this year I was fortunate to, I was invited to do a master copy of one of Richard Schmid's paintings. So you can see, actually I've got one of the paintings right here that I did. This is the second one that I did. And
that's beautiful.
We did film the day. Nancy was painting with Carol Arnold, doing a portrait painting, and Dallin and I were copying one of Richard's Tuscan little scenes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is a good segue. I need to pull up your work here. Let's start looking at some of your work.
Okay.
You are an exceptional draftsman. One of the things that I guess I noticed it before, but now that I've seen your drawings, it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are hard subjects to draw in plain air.
Yeah.
How do you, and I think, do you do these in one sitting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's most sort of paintings. I like, I don't really paint a la prima. I more like to think I'm probably more of a direct impressionist. I will start and finish where I put on a very thin wash or as thin as possible, and then build up that with thicker paint and thicker paint. I truly think it was the drawing.
But you do it in one sitting, though, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Isn't that what all this one might be? Just wet into wet, one sitting.
Actually, as my wife is Italian born, and I asked my mother-in-law, "How would you translate alla prima?" And she said, "Of one go or in one attempt." So technically, it is, but the classic Richard Schmid alla prima approach, where he sort of if he was painting this, he would paint the castle finished, and
then he'd sort of move
spread it out. Yeah, and he may go back and do a little touch on that area that he started, where I would do a big area of the background. I would draw in the focal point, the old building there, the castle. But no, so I do a slightly different approach, where it is in one go. And most of my plein air paintings, normally about 2 hours. But no, that's a subject that I absolutely love. And
yeah, you've got and some I think serious I've probably learned skills to do that architecture in such yeah. a so fast.
Yeah.
Look at that little car.
So,
brilliant.
Yeah. Actually, and I'm now, I was quite a traditionalist with my drawing, my only working from life, even though for an exhibition over the years, I would do my plein air painting trip and realize that, you know, I don't have enough material, especially when my sons were born, to be able to do 30 or 40 really great paintings. So I would work from photos. And so it was actually a learnt skill how to work from reference photos. And like the cows and that cow that you brought up, mm-hmm. That no, was actually
was.
Now I'm sort of going,
Well, here's a horse.
Or that horse. Photos? Yeah. That one was, actually, that was from one of my students' photos. Actually, I rarely paint from anyone's photos, but it was just such a lovely light. And mm-hmm. And I'm wanting to work, go into different areas. And but now I'm starting to use Procreate, where I was a super traditionalist, where if you were to go to, sometimes I'll bring a tractor in and into just a field in Vermont. And it was a tractor that was around the road. Actually, if anyone's interested, they can see this on my YouTube channel because we've just relaunched my YouTube channel and I go into some of these sort of Procreate things. And it's just Collie Wisson okay. on YouTube. Yeah, okay. Artist. Yeah, I think Collie Wisson Artist. Yeah, and they'll get to that. And let's see. If you drag back up.
Go ahead.
Okay, where? Oh, sorry. Yeah. I was going to bring up, we did a bit of a painting day with Casey Ball when I was in New York awesome. State. That was great fun. And he did a portrait and I did actually one of the paintings from Maine. So, if you drag back up again. I love doing the interiors. There's one from Atlanta and one from South Africa, the fire. Yeah, that's from an artist friend's place. And that I see is an extension of my still life. And if you keep going down on that side there, Jeff, all those chickens, say, if you bring that guy up, see, those chickens weren't there. The subject was laid out in front of me with all the hay bales, but I thought to make it one step further, so I use Procreate to put those chickens in. Oh. So I have learnt to and some people the idea, but I believe Ray Roberts in California, he's kind of embraced the idea. I'm not sure if he's still doing it, but I thought, you know,
a lot of artists are doing that now. Did you see my podcast with David Dibble?
I did, yes,
he's actually really David, into the digital, great painter and digital prep.
Actually that does raise a wonderful thing. I'm wondering what's in the water in Utah, and maybe I didn't drink enough of it because there's David. Brian Mark Taylor, you'll know them better than myself. There's such a great Joshua Clare, and
the names are escaping me.
And I thought, and maybe it's a bit like, because Australia, we don't have a huge population, but we had a good schooling. It has fallen a little bit on the wayside, the art gallery system, and there's still some of the art schools still going, but nowhere near as powerful as they were in the 70s, 80s, 90s. In the last 10 years, the gallery system has broken down. But I wonder if something similar, you had just a few good, really good teachers, say, in the 80s, 90s.
Back in the 70s, we had Alvin Gittins, and he taught a few other artists like Bill Whitaker, Randall Lake, and a few others. And then my generation was the next generation, including some of the ones you mentioned, like Brian Mark Taylor.
Mm-mm.
Who else did you mention? Josh Clare. Josh Clare's a little bit younger than me, but and then it just keeps on. I don't know. I think it started with a few really good ones when everyone else in the country was doing modernism. In the 70s, we had a few good teachers that were really gifted, and it's sort of.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what the reason is, but I don't know.
Mm-mm.
There's a lot.
And there's some great ones that we're probably just missing, but so actually that's why. Kimball Geisler,
he's in Idaho, but close
enough. Yeah, close, sort of that. Actually, Kimball came along to a workshop, I think, in 2017 or 18. He was already painting fantastic.
Oh,
he didn't
incredible.
Need any help from me.
Yeah.
So actually, on future trips, now that my work visa has run its course, I'll be aiming to catch up with Kimball, and we'll go out painting in Idaho. And
oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, I said to him, there's probably some things I can teach you still, but, boy, you can teach me how to paint mountains. And now he's doing seascapes. And
yeah, he's something else.
So it's a real thrill. It's a real thrill to actually get to paint with or teach and get to know some of you. Mark and I, we've had dinner together in Salt Lake City and swap paintings, and but just brilliant painters. And actually, I didn't know. We first met in San Francisco, so I didn't know he was from Utah and the Salt Lake area. So,
yeah.
But no, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. Keep,
Utah, I don't think anyone Utah really knows what's going on. But there are a lot of great painters here. And you just named the landscape painters. Mm. Then there's a whole bunch of figurative and still life painters too.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think Casey Childs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, it's funny when you mention that, ping comes the names.
Well, here's another interior that's just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny.
Freshness that's from, is what I love Mark. About your work. It's just so direct and to the point.
Yeah. And I truly believe it was that's why if you want to educate yourself, you're an artist, you're learning to paint, you're coming through, definitely draw as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the other really strong, powerful thing that I did was I drew for a month, painted for a month. Once I realized, you know what, because I was good with color, that was the family sort of thing. I could compose and knew where to put shapes, the big shapes. But I couldn't say that truck that's coming down the PCH there. I couldn't draw that to save my life as a 22, 21-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
My father said, I'll send you along to a pastel artist. I've just got to try and retrieve her name. But she was a brilliant teacher, brilliant pastel artist. And I went for 8 weeks and then kept drawing and painting. But then I realized, you know what, drawing is my great, great weakness. So I drew for a month, painted for a month, drew for a month. I did that for 12 months. And from that moment on, drawing has never been my weakness.
No
it truly
kidding.
Was.
That's inspiring.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah
and you
yeah,
drew and in the way that you showed us in with those samples.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yep. Just terrible versions, weaker versions, I guess. But actually, that does raise another point, Jeff, that I actually was about to throw a lot of those old drawing books away, and my wife said, no, it's kind of before we met at 25, and that's kind of your history before we met. And I thought, okay, I'll have a look through, and I'd flip through and go, oh, that's actually damn fine drawing. I didn't think I could draw that well as a 22 and a half year old. But the thing I noticed, it was then 15 or 20 drawings more. And within a couple of years, my oil paintings started to mirror the same thing. The good paintings, the good drawings got closer and closer together. The more I drew, the more I worked. I believe everyone's capable of doing good work if you get that training, if you get guidance. And I think that's what I love with my online course is that I've had about 300 students in the 7 or 8 years that I've been doing it. I'm able to give them daily. Actually, when we get off here, I'll do a little bit of online work and hopefully sort of get a little bit of time to do a small painting in the afternoon. But it's that ability to be able to and I always wish this was around when I was in my early to mid-20s. Someone like Matt Smith, Mitch Baird, or Skip Whitkin, Ken Backus, some of those sort of, and you name, actually I'd love to know some of your heroes because that always educates me. Oh, actually, my wife wanted me to pass on, and you've got the Stephanie Wisson seal of approval. She was very, I was impressed, of course, when I first saw you on a technical side, but my wife could see the quality in your work as well.
That's nice. I appreciate
thought,
that.
She thinks your work's a knockout. And I saw your work about 5 years ago. I think it was some of your backlit stuff, the portraits, and I thought, man, this guy's good. Who is he? Where's he from? And that's, I'm not sure when I started following you on Instagram, but I'd seen your work prior, and I wasn't really much of an Instagrammer myself.
Mm-hmm.
I probably have embraced it a bit more in the last 2 to 3 years, but I was always curious as to who do you look up to as well, especially
at the
moment.
It's easy to know who I look up to. Just look at the podcast lineup.
Right. Right. Yeah.
There's 80 question people answered. Right, well, there. 80 people. Yeah, and I've got hundreds more. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start, because like I said, those 80 are 80 people that yourself, that's why you're a guest, because I just absolutely admire you and your work. And, but man, there's endless. It's crazy how many good artists there are out there. When I first started this podcast, someone asked me, it might've been my wife, I can't remember who, but someone asked me and they said, how long can you do this every week? Because you're going to run out of artists. And I'm like, no, because I have this list, and every week or so, I probably find two or three more artists that come up in my feed. And I'm like, I'm never going to run out. I'm never going to catch up. And then 10 years down the road, there's going to be a whole nother group of artists that grew up.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
It is. Yeah. No, it's sometimes scary, but also very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And if you ever want, if you think, oh, geez, I want to tap into a few more Australian artists, I can send you a list of.
I was thinking about that. You've named so many people I've never heard of. I would be very appreciative if you sent me a list, because I'd love to add, I'd want to add some of these to my roster, because.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's so many artists I haven't even heard of that I'm sure would just blow my mind. It happens.
Oh, absolutely.
Time.
Actually, if you kind of like my work or
well, obviously I like your work.
Like what I'm doing. You will love a lot of these artists' work, because they're the artists that kind of were, that 10, 20 years older than me, and that inspired me to also, because they've become a lot of good friends as well. And we would teach together and swap paintings. And I'll organize
that. Send me that list. That would be amazing if you have time. Yeah. You're so busy, but I appreciate it.
Absolutely. No, I'm in a little bit of a sort of a rest mode at the moment, just to recover the body, still a little sore from the trip. And but I've got a massage coming up and a physical therapist treatment. So actually that's a good trick, is when you fly long distance, try and get a massage at your destination. It just works out. I had a massage when I got into Philadelphia, because I'd done the 8 days teaching there, and students, they're not normally at great heights, so you're normally hunched a little. And I do have the bit of sporting back, body, neck, nail trouble.
I have the worst posture when I paint. Oh my gosh.
Mm-mm. Yeah. So actually I do it as a maintenance when I'm painting here at home, but organize yourself for a massage at your destination. So when I get to Italy, I'll either get one straight after the first one, depending how I feel, but normally every 2 weeks. And it's like a rescue remedy. Boy, I've been so many times almost collapsing on my feet, and get that massage. You get your sleep improves, but that's a great help as well. I've been doing that, I think, since about 2011.
That's good advice.
As
you're talking, I'm listening to everything you're saying, of course, but I'm looking at your work, and I consider myself a pretty good draftsman, but I would be so intimidated by doing this in just a couple hours. You could, this perspective could fall apart really fast.
Actually, Matt Smith gave me a lovely pat on the back, and I thought, geez, coming from Matt Smith, he felt I was one of the top draftsmen that he had seen. And because you like yourself, you don't see yourself improving. But I'd always admired Matt's work and got the chance to meet, and we haven't had the chance to paint together, but I think it's just been mostly a learnt sort of skill, starting from those simple drawings and building on it, knowing where to place that emphasis as well. So
are you doing, when you do something like this, are you doing perspective lines to a vanishing point, or is this all just shape observation, and angle observation?
Just shape. I did slightly change the elevation just on the main big villa.
Intentionally?
And I don't mind doing that. Yeah.
And you still got it right.
Sometimes, yeah.
So, holy cow.
Sometimes I find some buildings, like some of the buildings in Maine, or when you're close to them, the perspective is so steep. And I feel, you know what, that's just going to run the viewer's eye straight out. So I'll flatten it in maybe 15%.
So you flatten that roof a little bit?
Just a little, yeah, probably only 5%. But I'm more than happy doing that. I don't want to scare you, Jeff, but I just noticed low power mode just came up on my iPad.
We're almost done anyway. I'm going to ask you.
Perfect. Yep. No, that's
good.
I just
want to look at a couple more. Hopefully we don't cut out here.
Oh, good.
But again, another sample of good drawing. You just don't. I mean, there's a lot of great, great landscape painters out there, but I find it really interesting that you said that drawing was your weakness, because if I were to put you alongside of a dozen random landscape painters on my list, I would have said that Kali Wisson's strength is drawing.
Right.
How interesting that you saw that as your weakness and made it your strength?
Yeah. Actually, I think because that's kind of a bit like a sports person who has a terrible curveball or something, and you work on it and it just shows. Actually, I really do appreciate it, because that's probably the one area that I had to learn, had to work hard at. And it's funny, it's something that I probably always loved doing as well. Actually, my father did say, he said early on, if you want to become a watercolorist or do watercolor painting, the better that you can draw, the easier that watercolor will come to you later. I love watercolor. And actually, when I was 23, 24, I was probably a more natural watercolorist. I think I do actually paint a little bit like a watercolorist, almost coming over with my darks a little bit at the end, which can be dangerous a little bit. But the medium that I use is a fast drying. It's guaranteed not to crack if you use it's archival lean medium, and it's a beautiful medium. But
what's it called?
I have to admit, this archival lean medium.
Okay.
It's a little scarce. It's a little scarce at the moment in the US. They've had the owner of the company passed away, and they had the manager of the warehouse in Philadelphia passed away. So they had a few little things, but it's a beautiful medium. It's like the old fashioned mediums, but it's highly developed with science. And but actually, just getting to the drawing, Jeff, that one did intimidate me quite a bit.
Holy crap.
Actually, I think I take strength from artist friends like David Curtis and Trevor Chamberlain. And David Curtis was such a great draftsman. And I thought, boy, and Streeton, some of those big paintings that he would do. Sometimes you think, how is it possible? And you do psych yourself out a little bit. But I think after seeing their work and just knowing that, you know what, there's a process to it. All you need to do is develop the right skills and work to that process. This one actually had a blue sky in behind it. And I thought, you know, I want to amp up the drama. And I think that's
that nice
Photoshop.
Contrast.
Yeah. And that's with Photoshop. I'm starting to. But if you went back to the Instagram, some of the boats and things like that one just down below it. That was. That's. I did a big 44 or 43 by 34 of that one. That was the study, I think. I was just never game to draw anything that big or that elaborate. Or even try and paint it. But I think patience long-term as well is good. We so much want to run before we can walk. But I always believe if you can do 3 paintings per week for minimum 2 to 5 years, you can go from an absolute beginner, start, amateur, beginning to paint to be able to do quite advanced work.
That's really helpful.
And I think, but I think you have to want it as well. Definitely that desire. I went from the carpentry picture framing, which was quite secure as a occupation, as an income. Mm-hmm. So I was But I could see that my father had raised seven kids, and we weren't all, even though we, my wife still thinks it's funny that we went to school with bare feet and didn't wear shoes until just before starting high school. And
that's crazy.
But Queensland's like Florida. She grew up in Melbourne, which is cold. So even in summer, it can be 55 or 50 degrees in summer because that Arctic breeze where in winter, it's barely 50 degrees on an average day in winter. It can get down to high 30s. That's just over freezing in Celsius. But we have a lovely environment. And I think Australia, we do have that strong sunlight. So I think that's been a huge inspiration to us and as landscape painters. And fingers crossed, I can get a few more years to paint away and
I hope so.
Sort of delve into some bigger paintings.
Stuff. So I got to ask you a final question before your battery dies on me.
Okay. Yep.
And you've already kind of given us a lot of advice. So if you got nothing else, if you're tapped out, I understand. But my final question is always the same.
That's cool.
And that is, if you could give one piece of advice that you wish you had, or that you had that was helpful to you, to an aspiring artist, what would it be?
It would be find the right partner.
Partner, wife, girlfriend. Like spouse?
Yes, yeah.
Really? Yep. That's good advice.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, because most artists are terrible at the business side. So my wife, she worked for Toyota and worked in a office sort of situation where she needed to. So even though she's very creative and now that, because if I'm teaching, she's working. With the teaching coming down or winding down, we're able to for her to sort of get back into some creative stuff. But she's been great one to run the business, but also have a lovely critical eye. But she supported me so well through everything. We met when we were 25, and I wish we met when we were earlier.
That's really nice. Awesome.
She's had some health issues this year, and I had my bit of health issue last year with a kidney stone and varicose vein surgery and a few other little things going on, which I won't sort of bore you with at the moment. But we're sort of getting to that age where we've worked hard and we're falling apart a little bit. But thankfully, I think modern medicine's been able to patch us up and keep us on track. But that's hugely important. I think I've seen so many artists that don't have that business sense, business structure, because ultimately I've seen so many great artists that you should have heard of, but have never heard of because, and they're artists of my father's era, my era, other artists coming through. So we can learn and retrieve all the technical information now online. People can watch so much online, how to paint a portrait, paint a still life, or paint a boat. But it's that behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
She's allowed us to have that ability to for her not to work when we had our sons. We had a small little a bit of money behind us that if we didn't sell anything for say 2 years, I didn't have to panic and go out and do carpentry or landscaping or picture framing. So that is so helpful and important, I find. She's really, as the old saying goes, behind every great man is a greater woman. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't have married a more beautiful, a more wonderful, a more trusting, a more powerful. Actually, most people see Steph and I as a bit of a power couple, and most people think, oh, I wish every artist had a Stephanie. she's just
amazing.
So on the ball. Yeah, no, she's incredible. And actually, not sure if we can fit it in 2025 next year, but we're hoping to do another a holiday to the US. And so if we get the chance, we'll try and sort of see if we can fit Salt Lake in. Or
I would love
or we'll
that.
See if we can.
And if you go painting with Kimball and you don't mind a third wheel, I'd love to come with you guys.
Oh,
too.
No. Kimball, no, more the merrier, more the merrier. Oh,
well,
cool.
You know what?
Yeah,
can I say something about your advice that I could not agree more? Although I will say this, there's so much more to it than even a business partner, because Like my wife has, she literally says to me, I don't want to be involved. I don't want to be involved in the business.
Okay.
At all. And she's just, yep. You know, and that's fine. But I remember when I was in school, my wife would have lived in a cardboard box. Everyone was telling me, my mother-in-law was telling me, my own mother was telling me, my father was telling me, my friends were telling me, everyone was telling me I'd never make it. And my wife was the only one that was like, eh, whatever, just do what you love.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And she would have lived in a hut or a box if she had to, because she's just, she's just not a materialistic person. And she never, ever pressured me. And I remember having friends at school that were getting so much pressure from their wife. You need to step it up and do something real with your life. And my wife never
did. Get that real job.
She never did. No, and now it's paid off for both of us because she's never had to work. And she's been able to stay home with the kids. And but it's because of her support. She's just, she was okay with me failing and just, let me do my thing, or and encourage me the whole way. Yeah, man, a good partner is powerful, everything, because it can make or break you.
Oh, absolutely. There's even earlier on, she would come in and sort of see how I was going or how I was painting. She said, "You know what? That part there, I don't quite understand what's happening there or what needs to happen." And I thought, "Oh, that was the part that I was worried about." But she was always on the money. So
yeah, like I said. My wife has also been a great support. So that's really good advice. And I hope to meet both of you someday.
Yeah.
It'd be great. Great if you came to Salt Lake.
Yeah. Actually, I was hoping to catch up with Kimball on this trip, but with my wife sort of needing the surgery, it was more important definitely for me to get home. And because she still, it's like 6 weeks, she still gets a little bit of discomfort. So
I'm sorry.
It's great. Thankfully, thankfully it wasn't cancerous or anything. It was a benign cyst. So it's just the body readjusting and all that. Right. So she's a tower of strength and very strong mentally and physically girl. So, and I nicknamed her the Princess of Pescara. She's born on the east coast of Italy, Principia of Pescara, the Princess of Pescara. So she's beautiful amazing. And inside and out. So she's a tough cookie. She won't take a backward step, but I think that's what has allowed me to and sometimes you need a little kick up the backside too. Mm-hmm. So when you start to doubt yourself, you know, can I paint that painting, or am I good enough, it's a match and marriage made in heaven. So
that's awesome, man. That's awesome. Well, you're she's gonna love to hear that. At least I hope she does.
I probably don't say it enough, but I probably don't say it enough, but
well, thanks again for being on the show. It's been a huge honor to get to know you. You're a master painter.
Thank you, and
it's been a privilege to pick your brain.
Anytime. Been a pleasure too. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for tuning in to the Undraped Artist Podcast. If you enjoyed it, subscribe. And if you could, leave a comment or review. That really helps the channel. Please share the show with your friends. And if you're feeling generous, consider a monthly donation at theundrapedartist.com. Thanks again for watching. We'll see you next week.